Good evening and welcome to Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. Tonight, Trevor Harris is in with a fascinating show about history. That's not the history we studied in school. There's no Napoleon or George Washington, but this is the history that really matters. Your family, your grandparents, your history. We'll talk about ways to gather your family history and then hear about a project recording the history of some of Columbia's families, preserving our community's history. We're going to hear from recordings of Columbia's Marva Jo Brown as she talks about how the desegregation of Columbia schools affected African-American families here in our town. That's next, Thinking Out Loud from KBIA.
A couple of years ago, I started recording my grandma. I asked her about growing up in St. Charles, about moving with my grandpa to Seattle as part of the effort that was World War II. For me, these captured conversations helped me remember stories of my grandma. Listening back, I get to hear Mildred Harris's voice mostly as it still sounds today at age 91. I checked with her. She said I could tell you her age on the radio. This is Millie's grandson, Trevor Harris, for KBIA, and this week on Thinking Out Loud, we take a look at oral history. The University of Missouri employs one, count them one, oral historian. This week, we'll talk with Jeff Corrigan about what he collects and why, but let me back up a step, though. What got my attention was a mention in the recent Missouri History Times. Not a subscriber, you say? It's a members-only publication of the State Historical Society of Missouri, something to keep you fueled about happenings in the world of Missouri history. In a recent Missouri History Times, I read mention of Roxanne Foster. In pursuit of her master's degree at MU in journalism, Foster interviewed white and black Columbians about their experiences living in Columbia before and after Brown versus Board of Education Topeka led to the desegregation of public schools across America. Roxanne Foster and Jeff Corrigan are the guests on this week's Thinking Out Loud. So what was it that you ended up ultimately doing for your master's project?
I collected oral histories from 10 plus interviewees. I think it ended up being 12. People who were part of the desegregation process in Columbia, looking specifically at people who were in high school between 1954 and 1961, right after the Brown decision. And I was looking for people who had a diversity of experience, so I wanted to talk to people who chose to stay at Douglas, people who voluntarily moved to Hickman, those who had to move because the high school courses at Douglas were phased out around 1960, and then people who were always at Hickman. I wanted to really just try to understand what that experience was like from their point of view and hear their story from their perspective.
Beyond collecting the stories, do you have a journalistic intention of something to do with these stories, or was it the act of getting the stories into the society, getting them out there so people can listen to them and research them and use them?
Mm-hmm. For me personally, and this was kind of something that we talked about a lot, my master's committee and I, for me personally, it was about archiving the material. I wanted to make sure that the memories and experiences of the people I talked to were actually put into a place where people could access them, they could hear them, they could learn from them. And so I went into the project not having any kind of journalistic expectation whatsoever, which in Columbia, where a lot of people are used to talking to journalism students, it confused a lot of people. Everyone wanted to know what I was going to do with it, and I had to explain to them this was really just for purposes of archiving them. So that's still where I stand at this point. I don't have, like, a grand plan. There's no book that I'm thinking of writing or anything like that. It was really for my own personal understanding and then also to help foster understanding for other people who would come after me and experience their stories as well.
My name is Trevor Harris. I'm visiting with Roxanne Foster. She has a graduate degree in journalism from the University of Missouri. We're talking today on Thinking Out Loud about some oral histories that she collected recently in pursuit of her master's degree. Roxanne, I'm curious, you didn't know these individuals who you collected their stories, correct?
No, I did not.
Did you have any challenges getting access to them? I would think a lot of these experiences for these people are distant past, maybe in some cases not necessarily a great time that people would want to discuss, although at some level everybody wants to be remembered and have their story told. But did you have any challenges getting access to your interview subjects?
Yes and no. I think that I had some great guidance from Jeff and also from my advisor at Mizzou to find the gatekeepers in the community and talk to them and have them talk to other people on my behalf. And so that's what I did. Initially, the going was a bit slow the first couple of weeks, trying to get people to agree to sit down and talk to me for between 1.5 and 5 hours, depending on how much time they wanted to give. Basically what happened is one door opened and I talked to one person and that person talked to somebody else and then those people talked to somebody else. And so I ended up at the end of the process having more interviewees than I could handle in the time frame I was working with.
We'll hear more from Roxanne Foster and one of her interview subjects later in the show. Did you catch that Roxanne mentioned Jeff? That's Jeff Corrigan, the oral historian who advised Roxanne on her project. As the staff member at the State Historical Society of Missouri charged with gathering Missourians' stories, Corrigan has an important and influential role. When researchers of the 22nd century drop in to research the lives of Missourians way back in the 21st century, it's Jeff who decides who's in the archives and what they're talking about. It was surprising to me to learn that most people who access the State Historical Society's oral history archives read a lot more than they listen. Here's Jeff Corrigan.
It might be interesting to know that most people don't want to listen to the audio. They actually are interested in the transcript. Transcripts you can edit. You can read through them very quickly. You can keyword search them if it's a PDF or a Word document. Researchers and students, they like to see transcripts. They can cite pages better. They can make better citations. And it's also easier to read. You know, a three-hour interview you have to listen to for 3 hours. A three-hour interview you can read in probably an hour. So I kind of approach my job in the sense that I don't try to think or fathom collecting all of Missouri's history. I can't do it. I'm one person and it's too big of a job. So what I try to do is I try to think, okay, in 50 years, what are people going to be interested in? Who are they going to want to listen to? Who's not being recorded now? So what I do is I have a variety of collections, some that I inherited from my predecessors, and then some that I've created on my own. And through those different collections and those different topics, it's enough of a cross-section of Missourians that anybody that's looking at them will be able to understand Missouri and its people at that time period through one of these collections. Because the topics are very broad, the collections I collect in. I have about 7 core collections that I collect in. My favorite is actually the Missouri Environmental Oral History Collection. I have an environmental science background before I became a historian, and I basically document Missouri's environmental history, which is a little difficult because the environment is not a person. And so to document it, I have to document the environment through people. And so I kind of break it up into different categories, and I collect those interviews because Missouri is a conservation state. Missouri is the first conservation state. It was the first state to have a conservation department, the Missouri Federation. It's quite old, and it's a lot of history here. And a lot of other state systems are built on ours. So I try to interview people, whether it be a cave biologist, or I interviewed an Emmy Award-winning photographer and movie maker that makes nature films. I've interviewed an outdoor writer. I've interviewed actually a gentleman who was at the first Federation meeting as a boy with his father, who's still currently living here in Columbia. He's about 96 years old. He was quite a treat to listen to and to get that initial conversation that took place to Missouri's going to cares about the environment. And so there is an environmental movement now, and so that topic is very popular, but the environmental movement's been going on a long time. It started back in the 60s, but even before that in Missouri, it was in the 30s. Missouri had no deer population left. Missouri, a lot of things, there was no regulation. People overhunted, they poached things, and we wouldn't have what we have today without those people. And so I try to document that history through the environmental collection.
This is 91.3 FM, KBIA Columbia, and you've dropped in on Thinking Out Loud. Each week, we focus on some person or event in mid-Missouri that KBIA listeners deserve to know more about. This week on Thinking Out Loud, we're learning about oral history. That's different from your dental charts. This oral history is the process of capturing the culture and memory of a time through the voices of people who lived through it. At the start of this program, I mentioned that I collect stories from my grandma. She won't be around forever, neither will I. I record her answers to my questions so I can get a listenable record of my family's history. I asked State Historical Society of Missouri oral historian Jeff Corrigan for some advice on how to get the best possible audio when collecting oral histories.
There are ethical questions. You want to make sure that nobody is secretly being recorded. You have to think somewhere along the lines of journalism, too, that You want people to be open and honest, but you want them to know what's going on. You want them to have informed consent. If you're planning on using it outside of your family, you're going to want to have a deed of gift or a signed consent form that says, you know what, in your case, your mother, your grandmother, you can say, you know, I'm going to record this and this is going to be great for me and my children, but I think this would be great for the community's history. You know, every community in Missouri, they either have a public library, they have a local historical society. All of these things are great, but most of the time they're going to need a signed deed of gift, if nothing else, that it's spoken on there, that I know that I'm giving this and this is where it's going to be, so that people can use it. We want to preserve Missouri's history, but we need that permission. We need to know that this person knew they were being recorded and that they can so it can be placed in an archives or repository. So the Oral History Association of America, it's the association throughout the country. That's a great one. There's also a great document. If you had to condense the field of oral history down to 20 pages, Baylor University, it's called the Baylor University Institute for Oral History. They have this wonderful free PDF online that people can just download and look at. And it basically, if you were going to take on any type of project, whether it be interviewing a family member or interviewing a whole community, it kind of breaks down what you need to think about in about 20 pages. So it's a really condensed piece of information there that Baylor puts out. Equipment is so cheap nowadays. You know, you can set yourself up in a quiet room. A lot of people, I interview a lot of people in their homes. And what's interesting is I want them to be comfortable, but the most comfortable place in their home is actually the most distracting place, because they have a television in front of them, they have a telephone next to them, there might be a fan, there might be a whole number of things surrounding them. So you have to be conscious of making sure those things are off. You try to think about, you know, cuckoo clocks and grandfather clocks and making sure everything's shut off. But if you can just sit in a quiet room with, you know, two individuals, I try to keep in no more than three people in a room, so it's not a huge conversation, a quiet interview, a decent $50 to $100 recorder maybe, you can do an oral history and you can preserve your family's history. It doesn't take thousands of dollars to do it. Some people may do that, but it's not necessary just to get that recording down. I try to always interview one person at a time, but if there's other people in the room, sometimes they can be a good cue and give a little tips here and there, because they've heard these stories for the last 20, 30, 40 years. And they want to make sure they're on tape. And their favorite stories, too. You know, they always seem to have some, well, you haven't told them this story about World War II. Or you haven't tell them this story about when the plane blew up and when you were fighting in World War II. Oh, okay. Yeah. I'll tell them now. And so that's always good to have. Some people can help give recall. Another thing that people can do if they're interviewing somebody and they're not sure that they can talk that much about it is to have props. Pull out a scrapbook. Pull out photographs. You know, if you're doing that and you can make a video recording, that's great, because then you can show the photograph along with the recording so people would know what you're talking about. But just a photograph, an old photograph can trigger a lot of memories and put people back into the movie of their life. That's what we like to call it, is that, you know, you're trying to get the person to tell you their life story, their oral history as they saw it and experienced it. It's that first person account. So if they can put themselves back in the movie of their life, then that's the best that you can do to record that. Yeah, I used to speak too much in my first oral history interviews. And the best way to improve at an oral history too is that once you've done one, most people never go back and listen to them again. They just record them on, they record them, hand them to the person they interviewed for or their family and move on. And if you can listen to yourself, and if you can listen to yourself interview somebody for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, you will very quickly learn what your problems are, what your mistakes are. I have to transcribe a lot of our interviews. And so every time I speak, that's something else I have to transcribe. So I'm very conscious about not interrupting people. You know, a simple nod of the head acknowledges that you understand what they're saying. You don't have to say yes. You don't have to interrupt somebody. You know, good eye contact and just kind of a nod of the head lets the person know that you're listening, that you care, and that you want to hear more, but it doesn't interrupt them. And so I always try to keep quiet. I'm much better than I was when I started. It was quite a few interviews ago, but you just learn to be quiet, because you just have to remember the oral history interview is about them and not about you. You just have to just take the information as they give it to you. Don't worry about whether you like what they say or don't like what they say. It's their oral history. So as long as you just let them be, that's the best oral history that you can have.
Getting the best oral history that you can possibly have was one of the key motivations for Roxanne Foster. Remember her? Roxanne earned a master's degree last year from the world-famous University of Missouri School of Journalism. Her topic? Gather stories of Colombians who experienced the desegregation era in Colombia. Speaking to me by phone from her home in Austin, Texas, Roxanne recently told me what kind of themes emerged in the Colombia interviews that she conducted last year.
The way that I structured my questions and the discussions that I had with people was broken down into four phases. And, you know, the first one was paint a picture for me of what it was like to grow up in Colombia. And that basically opened the door for them to talk about whatever they wanted, you know, within reason. We talked about family. We talked about friends, the fun stuff they did as kids, where they lived, their church life, things like that. And it got them comfortable with talking. And then from there, I talked about the school years and then the actual desegregation process and the after effects, what changes they saw in the community. And I noticed across the board, people talked about what it was like to grow up in Colombia. There was this really great sense of nostalgia that came through, which is very common with oral histories, I'm told, or what my research has shown. When people discuss their childhood and growing up and things like that, they just painted this really vivid and beautiful picture of the community that they were from. And depending on who you were talking to and how they experienced the desegregation process, whether they were forced to go, if they chose to go and had some regrets about it, or if they went and had the best experience ever, universally, there was a sense that their childhood and growing up, even under the strictures of segregation, was a beautiful thing. And then after that, I noticed that for many of the African Americans I talked to, there was a really deep sense of loss, and usually it was a sense of loss of community or sense of identity that came about with desegregation. And I did interview two white men who were at Hickman, and they both pretty much said that they thought the change brought about much-needed progress in the community, but they felt that things weren't quite where they needed to be today. So I think those were the big two that came out of it. But then there was also a third one that, in the minds of many, desegregation and urban renewal in Colombia are inextricably linked. Like, those two things cannot be separated in their minds, which I found really interesting because I'm not from Colombia, so I didn't know about urban renewal. So that opened up a whole other area that I needed to research and understand.
One of Roxanne Foster's interview subjects was Colombian Marva Jo Brown. Thanks to Foster's scholarship, the Marva Jo Brown interview is now archived in the State Historical Society of Missouri, along with a growing set of interviews from Brown's peers. These are all individuals who grew up in Colombia in the middle part of the 20th century and experienced the desegregation era firsthand.
Can you tell me, what was it like for you growing up here?
It was great growing up in Colombia. It was a small enough city. My parents were always together. It's like when you ask one, you had to have permission from them both on the same page. It was a large family. We lived kind of like in the country at the time because my parents were the first one to build a house where we lived. We lived right where Joe Malkin's big thing is, right on Providence, coming right off the freeway. There was a whole community there. And they built their house there, so we went from where Providence is up to M&M, and I don't, M&M's probably to almost to halfway to Indiana Street. So we had like a farm. We had cows and pigs. We had gardens. We had dogs. All kind of dogs ran in the yard. Cats. There were rabbits there, so we got a good grip on what animals were. There was not a playground at the time, and my mom, it was a vacant lot next to our house. My mom turned it into a playground that the neighbors played. Everybody came. We had big events during the year. We did fundraisers, and the neighborhood just worked together. It was an integrated neighborhood. A lot of relatives lived in the area. And one thing this is going ahead, but one thing that I found that when I moved back to Columbia from Wisconsin, in this area where I live now, there's still a lot of the people that lived across the highway. We were known as the Highway Gang. Cemetery Hill was Cemetery Hill Gang. We played ball against each other at Douglas Park. We had, when we had things there, people all came, and we just enjoyed growing up there. We lived, when I was younger, we had outside water, we had outside toilet, we had coal stoves, so you had to come home from school and do your chores of the home. You had to do your schoolwork, and you had to get your clothes ready for school the next day, and you had to be on the porch by sundown.
How did you hear about the plan to desegregate the high schools?
Well, my parents talked about it a lot and was trying to decide whether we would go to an all-white school versus going to the black school, whether all of us would go or one of us would go. And so they talked about it. And to me, it just didn't make any difference, like, you know, until the time came.
Like, were you there when they would talk about it?
Yeah, they would talk about it to us and stuff.
Okay, so they talked about it with you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how did that conversation go?
Well, you know, if this Brown versus Kansas, they were excited about it. It'll be a better education, but will it be better for you? And I want to decide, would you like to go or wouldn't you like to go? And what would be the criteria for us going? And so I was the only one that they moved. Because my mom says, you're closer to home. All I have to do is walk up the street and I'm in the classroom. And if your dad has a car that day, it doesn't matter because I can still get there. You will be forced to not be with friends, and you will be forced to learn. Even though I think you've done a great job at Douglas, I think this will help you, and how do you feel about that? And I thought, I really don't want to go, but if that's what you say I need to do, that's what I will have to do. So that's how I went to Hickman.
So what did it feel like going into Hickman that very first day?
Oh my God, it was, I come from Douglas, which probably had, we had 13 kids graduate from my class that I was in Douglas. So I walked from Douglas, being a much smaller school, into this sea of white faces, that the building is much larger, and that's all you see. Do I get to see the other four girls that was there? No, usually not during the day. And it was like, oh my, where are the classrooms? How do I get to class? Where do I go? Who do I ask? But somebody must have helped me go to classroom. Probably just don't remember it. But after the first year, it wasn't this bad, because then it was more kids that came to Hickman. So, and then I knew people, like on first name basis, that I could say, well, what did you do in your class today? Or how did this work? Or what did that do? And in my biology class, we had to dissect a worm, and I knew the stuff and knew how to write the stuff down, but I just could not touch that worm inside and out. And Wayne Reynolds walked over to me and said, if you do the writing, I'll do the dissecting, and together we'll do our project. And that's how that happened. And I think that I got into the vocal choir. It was a choir where you just did poems and things. I got into that, and that opened up more friendships and stuff too. And I kind of really liked that, even though the woman did the same thing every year. But but that I did do. And it was by graduation time, I was okay.
That was the voice of Marva Jo Brown. Brown shared her recollections of growing up in Columbia and attending Douglas and then a desegregated Hickman High School. She shared those stories with Roxanne Foster, who collected the stories of Brown and other Colombians who grew up during the desegregation era here in Colombia. These histories were transcribed, and the transcriptions along with the audio are now part of the State Historical Society of Missouri's Missouri Desegregation and Civil Rights Oral History Project files. Thanks to Roxanne, oral historian Jeff Corrigan, and Marva Jo Brown for originally sharing her stories with Roxanne.
All right, nice job on the program this week from our Trevor Harris. It's Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. We want to thank this evening's guests, Jeff Corrigan and Roxanne Foster. Thanks to Millie Harris, too. And we thank you very much for listening. Join us for the rest of the programs in our Thinking Out Loud family. Catch the Maplewood Barn Radio Theater this Friday evening at 6:30. Saturday morning, we're keeping our fingers crossed. We're hoping for what could be a very, very special Thinking Out Loud Saturday Sports. Don't want to make any firm announcements yet until we get our guest confirmed, but we've got a very, very special guest we're hoping to get for Saturday Sports. And then join us again next Tuesday evening for another Thinking Out Loud right here on KBIA. Till then, for Trevor Harris, I'm Darren Hellwedge. Have a great evening. ¶¶